Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Everybody, Dan Abrahams, my friend. This is probably episode, I don't know, six. I don't know, maybe more. This is you're a regular fixture, though. I love you dearly, and I know that our audience always appreciates hearing from you. How are you?
I'm very well, Don. And just to say, it's an honor and delight to be with you. Always is. We've done this a few times, and I always love every single second of speaking to you about soccer. You've forgotten more about soccer than I'll ever know, but I can always contribute a little bit with the psychological element. So no, it's always lovely, and it's so awesome to be involved with your organization, SIUSA, and all the great work yourself and Chris Cousins and all of the people, because there's loads of people involved in your organization now. So I always lose count.
Yeah. Well,
so
you know, our kids, our clients appreciate, you know, how great you've been allowing them to participate in the Dan Abraham Soccer Academy. And I get comments from parents all the time, how fantastic the Dan Abraham Soccer Academy in it. And I don't expect you to do a shameful plug for it, but I will gladly say that the parents and players genuinely appreciate the help. So,
well, you know, Don, I mean, my passion is to demystify the mental side of soccer, which I've been doing for many, many years now, I suppose, of sport in general, but very much soccer. You know, there's so many young players who are heading off to college and utilizing your services there at SIUSA who, you know, maybe they've had a little bit of exposure to the mental side, but often they haven't done. So it's sometimes something new when they log on to the my online academy and they find there's a whole bunch of videos. There's dozens, up to 100 videos there, actually sort of introducing them to simple mental techniques that help them build their confidence, pinpoint their concentration, engage in self-control, communicate more effectively, learn quicker and more effectively. So it is something new for them. And so it's wonderful to give them the opportunity just to be exposed to a little bit of that work. I mean, I think you'd agree with me, there's too many young players who have a lot of skill in their feet who don't get the opportunity necessarily. I mean, there's wonderful, wonderful coaches out there now across the US and across the world, but I still think we're still somewhat in our infancy in introducing mental skills to players, and coaches are often a little bit worried or have a little bit of trepidation, I think is the word I'm trying to look for here, in terms of trying to help players mentally. But I think they're in a great position to do so. So, you know, I make it my business to travel a lot and introduce mental skills to coaches that they can use with players. And obviously directly, I work with players and through my online academy as well, which very kindly have incorporated into your SIUSA offering. So yeah, it's wonderful to be part of the team.
Yeah, you know, it's I know as a coach, as a younger coach especially, I was scared to talk about the mental side of the game because I knew how important it was and I knew how quickly I could screw things up for my players by doing it wrong. And I think to have your guidance, I think is really important. So you just mentioned something. You talk about players not really, in general, and we're generalizing, and even up to the pro players that don't really understand what's going on in their own heads and aren't really aware when they have negative thoughts that they are negative thoughts. You know, the negative thoughts and just our thoughts in general flow through our head. And I don't know what the speed is. You probably know what the cognitive scientists say that the speed of thoughts flowing around in the human head is. But it's unbelievable when you consider the amount of thoughts that flit in and out, in and out, in and out, so quickly. And I was just talking to the episode that'll come out right before this is Steve Purdy. Steve Purdy played for U.S. youth national team up until the age where he realized he wasn't quite going to be good enough to make the national team and went and played for El Salvador. Then he went and played in Germany in the second Bundesliga and then played in the MLS for a bunch of years. And Steve and I, Steve brought up the fact, and all I could do was think about you and thinking, I wonder what Dan would say. But Steve was talking about the how his confidence would ebb and flow, that when he came back from Germany in the Bundesliga, everything went so right. The coaches did everything right for him, that his confidence was soaring when he came back to the United States. He felt invincible. And then when he came back, he played for Dallas, and he said the whole environment was just different. And then he picked up an injury, and he said his confidence plummeted. And then he went and played in the USL for a while with Portland before they became an MLS team, and his confidence soared again. And then his confidence plummeted. And he talked about these ups and downs and ups and downs. And I thought, oh, how relatable is that? I mean, that is, isn't that life, Dan, for all of us, that we feel good one day, crap another day? So, yeah, what can players do? What can people do? But what can players do to not let your highs get too high or your lows get too low?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, what a fascinating conversation that must have been with Steve. And I think those conversations are, or those stories, I should say, are to a penny in global soccer and probably global sport. You know, players having all these different kinds of experiences because you do over a playing career, you have positive experiences, ne negative experiences. You're playing great 1 week or 1 month, and then not so great the next month. What you're in one supportive environment, one season, and what could be considered an unsupportive environment the next season. And so I've always felt it's really important. I know how important the environment is. So there's no question about that. But ultimately, an individual player can't control what environment they're walking into. So
That's right.
I've always worked on the philosophy that, you know, yes, I want to help coaches and clubs, teams, organizations around the world optimize their environment and help them understand the importance of a what I might call a safe and healthy environment, a psychologically informed environment, which we could come on to talk about, absolutely. But I'm also passionate about individual players themselves being tooled up, if you like, to be able to deal with the ups and downs, the ebbs, the flows, and the difficult, unhealthy and unsafe environments that they can walk into at any given time. I think this is imperative. And so to speak to some of your questions here, I mean, actually, let's reverse up to the first thing you said. How quick does the brain work? Now, I don't know if I can give you an ultimate measurement, but it's funny, Don. I mean, you were a goalkeeper and goalkeeper coach, and I've just returned from Philadelphia, actually. I had a wonderful 2 days working at a goalkeeper conference where I delivered a couple of presentations, then had the delight of doing some work with the Philadelphia Union. But with respect to the goalkeeper conference, one of the things I had a little slide up because I wanted those goalkeeper coaches, and I want any coach, to understand the speed of the brain with relation to the speed of the game. Okay, so let's start on the pitch and then we'll draw it back off the pitch because obviously Steve had some challenges on and off the pitch, perhaps from a confidence perspective. So the game works in seconds, doesn't it? It's like the old adage of it takes a second to score a goal, it takes a second to complete a pass and all that. But here's the thing, the brain is working in milliseconds. Okay, so the brain trumps soccer for speed every single time. It works much
Right.
quicker. Now, here's the interesting thing. So, number one, rule number one here, the brain works in milliseconds, the game works in seconds. Number two, in very simple, stripped back terms, the way our brain is designed is to judge what's going on around us. It's to judge what's going on around us. And that can be on the pitch, on the field of play, when we're playing, when we're competing. It could be, you know, at the training ground, when we're, you know, being selected or we're training, we're engaging in activities, we're just in the dining hall having some lunch. You know, our brain is designed to judge what's going on around us. And it kind of hones in on threats and rewards, threats and
Right.
rewards. And I'm saying this because this links into confidence, because we experience, as a consequence of the threats and rewards that are going on around us, right? A threat could be being left out of the team. A threat could be a coach having a go at us. A threat could be starting on the bench. A threat could be the mistake I've just made. The threat could be an amazing opposition. A threat could be having a poor activity in a session. A threat could be a fumble from a goalkeeper. You can count threats in potential thousands around us at any given time that are present oriented, past oriented, and future oriented, because our brain is that kind of time traveler, right? It goes
Real
back.
or imagined, right, Dan? I mean,
Oh,
real or imagined. The amount of
very much so.
imagined threats that we have are probably far exceeding the amount of real threats that we have, I'm
Very
guessing.
Yeah, very, very, very well said. And that's all steeped in evolutionary psychology. And so, and there are rewards as well, Don, you know. So, you know, having a great training session, a great pass, a goal scored, you know, a reward can be a bit of praise. A reward can be perceived as we're playing the bottom of the league team this coming week, and it's going to be simple, it's going to be easy. So
Right.
there are rewards as well. Anyway, the brain works in milliseconds. Everybody listening in, think about this. Your brain is working in milliseconds. It's designed to consciously judge what's going on around you. And the way it trades is through detecting threats and rewards. So that's the judgment it's making. And so we create stories of those threats and rewards, shaped
Right.
as thoughts, emotions, feelings, shaped as thoughts, emotions, feelings. So, as to speak to your point earlier, our thoughts, emotions, feelings happen to us. So, you know, if you think about, you know, and I'm going to riff perhaps on what Steve was talking about with you about last week. You know, he said he had a great time in Germany. So there's loads of rewards there. Perhaps he got a lot of praise from the coaches. Perhaps he had really great coaching, great support, and great teammates, and they won some games. So all these rewards. And so his thoughts, emotions, feelings are happening to him, and he's creating these stories about how good everything is. And these stories are rich with, as I said, emotion and feeling. So what does that do? That raises his confidence. He feels great. You know, it puts him with what I call energy forward, approach behavior, positive intent. He's in that bodily position to execute actions purposefully, positively, and proactively. You know, to me, that is confidence, right? But maybe he goes to Texas, he goes to Dallas, and no disrespect to them back then, but it sounds to me like maybe he stepped in an environment. Maybe it was an environment that was overly critical, or he didn't get the opportunity to play in the position he wanted to play, or perhaps there was a style of play that didn't suit him, or he just, you know, he had a first few training sessions and it didn't go so good, and he didn't adapt so well, and he didn't wasn't exposed to any positive reinforcement. So suddenly, again, what's his brain doing? Working in milliseconds, scanning for threats and rewards. In this case, lots of threats. And so the stories he's creating, which are rich in emotions and feelings, are suddenly depleting, are sending up thoughts, emotions, feelings that are depleting confidence. You know, he's feeling anxious and worried and doubting. He's perhaps feeling a little bit stressed, so he starts to experience in his body a bit of inhibition and a bit of hesitancy. And really, inhibition and hesitancy are the forerunners to a drop in confidence, or a physical signature of low confidence. And so this is how this plays out. And I suppose that's a little bit of a deep dive, but this is what's happening under the surface. The main mechanisms here for everybody listening in to take this sequentially: your brain is working milliseconds, your brain is constantly judging what's going on around you. It's detecting threats and rewards. It's sending up thoughts, emotions, feelings as a consequence of that detection. And that is constantly mediating, let's say, confidence. And so now Steve drops in confidence, plays energy back, inhibited, hesitant, etc. And so let's come back to your main point, that you're sitting there listening to Steve and you're thinking, hey man, you know, he could really have done at that time with some very simple techniques within a very simple mental framework that would have allowed him to better respond to the thoughts, emotions, feelings that he was having. You know, and rife now is this notion of stimulus response. But stimulus response is often about what happens outside of you. So, you know, there's a mistake made and you have this opportunity to respond positively. What we don't often talk about is stimulus response when the stimulus is inside of us. So the stimulus being a thought that's negative, an emotion that's negative, a feeling that's negative. But again, we can't control having negative thoughts, emotions, feelings, or unhelpful thoughts, emotions, feelings. But we can take charge and take control of our response to those. So again, and we can have a very broad and deep conversation about what Steve can do, but in very simple terms, it would be him starting to use his self-talk to try to weave a more productive story in his mind. Hey, I'm here at Dallas. Okay, there's some things I don't like, but what do I like here? Okay, what was I doing in Germany that really worked? What action words might I borrow? Was I upbeat? Was I sharp? Was I alert? Was I alive? Right, I was those. I'm going to embody those. What do I need to concentrate on? Right, I need to concentrate on the next action. Always, I need to have external focus of attention, getting in the cues and the clues and the triggers that are going on around me. I need to be immersed in that. I need to be action hungry. I need to make sure that I give myself my best chance to be action hungry to win the next next moment, even if I've lost a bunch of moments. So you see, Don, the point is there's all these many things, all these many techniques that a player can use to respond appropriately to the negative thoughts, emotions, feelings, something I call ANTS, automatic negative thoughts that they've been having, in order to retain a sense of confidence. And even if your confidence drops a little bit, let's say down to 7 out of 10, can I be 7 out of 7? Can I get the most from the confidence that I'm feeling on that day? Ultimately, it's about being a sophisticated competitor. A sophisticated competitor is somebody who has the tools, the techniques, the approaches and frameworks to deal with all the challenges that are going on around themselves and inside of themselves.
It's it seems to me, you know, it's funny, Dan. So about roughly 10 years ago, somebody introduced me to meditation, and I started doing it. And a month or so into it, a thought clicked to my head that, oh, I'm thinking. And I thought, this is crazy that I lived 50 years of my life without realize how much I'm thinking. Now, that might sound stupid to people listening, because of course we all think. I mean, you know, intellectually, I knew that I thought.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that I could actually recognize the thoughts that were going through my head. And that once I started recognizing those thoughts, I could then more quickly categorize them and squash the ones that weren't helpful to me, if that makes sense, right? And I'd say I know that some people listening to this are going to go, that sounds so stupid, but it's true that I went most of my life without realizing that I was thinking. I was just reacting to everything.
Really interesting, Don, and it's so true that you know, self-awareness is that first step in change, because if you're not aware, I completely empathize with where you were. I've worked with many players who are in a similar position, and to speak to your point, it's interesting that you engaged in meditation and that process, that tool or technique in and of itself. I suppose it's an approach these days with a vast range of tools in many respects, help you to become more aware of your inner self. Because as you say, I've worked with players who, whether it's thoughts, it can be emotions, it can be feelings. People aren't necessarily what in science they call interoceptively aware. So when we think of sense data hitting our brain and nervous system, there's two main types. There's exteroceptive data, if I can say that word, which is senses coming from the outside. It's what you see in the outside world. It's what you hear from the outside world. It's what you even feel from the outside world kinesthetically. But then there's this word of interoceptive data, which is basically the data thrown back from your body to your brain. And that's the feelings inside of you. It's that rising feeling of panic or stress. It's the butterflies in your stomach. It's a high heart rate. And as well, it's thoughts as well. You could think of it as thoughts. And so not everybody is aware of their inner sensations, their bodily emotions, or their emotions residing in their body and the thoughts that are emerging. They're just happening to them, and as they happen to them, as you say, they respond to them, and they're in whether it's an unhelpful way or a passive way, just going along with those thoughts. And so subsequently they don't take a step back and go, okay, that's not helpful right now,
right?
I really don't want to respond to that thought in that way, I don't need to react to that thought in that way. I want to respond more appropriately. And so I love the fact that you engaged in meditation. I mean, what, again, I'm going to speak in very simple, stripped back terms here. You've got meditation and mindfulness, and they can be confused as the same thing, and there's probably enormous similarities. But the best definition I can give to both is that when you are meditating, you are taking hold of your concentration, and you are, for example, and there's many forms of meditation, but you can, for example, breathe. Maybe you're going to breathe 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out. So you're going to enjoy 6 breaths per minute, and you're going to focus your attention on those breaths. You're going to be non-judgmental. Maybe your mind's going to wander, but you're going to purposefully bring your attention back to your breaths. So there's a sense of control with meditation. Focus on your breaths, 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out. Your mind will wander. You gently bring your mind back to your breaths, a sense of control. Mindfulness is a little bit different, in as much as you can breathe by all means. You can start with breathing, but you're just letting your mind wander. You're just there. and you're just noticing your thoughts, you're noticing the feelings in your body, you're noticing the movements in your body, you're noticing things change and shift. And so what are you doing in that? You're becoming an expert in the shifting senses that you're experiencing. So meditation, a sense of control, where you still get to notice your attention shift, and you can shift it back purposefully. Mindfulness, you're just being and allowing your attention to shift and just noticing those shifts and being non-judgmental, just letting them happen. Mm-hmm. But again, both of these work in servitude to this notion of attention control and self-awareness. And that's the self-awareness, especially, is that critical first step in taking control of your attention, taking control of yourself. That's critical.
Fascinating. So in the last 5 years, I know I asked you about this years ago, but maybe our first interview that we ever did, and you weren't as specific, or it feels like you had some personal experience with this in the last few years. Is that true?
I think, you know what, I think that my background is professional golf, and I strove at that time to utilize meditation especially, and I just felt it didn't in the end translate. Now I felt I could do a lot of that work just by purposefully, when I was, say, on the driving range hitting golf shots, or I was on the course playing with friends, or on the course in competition, I found the context specific nature of my challenges really important. So I would try to catch that ant, that automatic negative thought, when I experienced it, and tried to shift it in the contextual environment in which I was competing or in which I was practicing. So I felt, for me personally, that was the most important thing. And I didn't find engaging in meditation or mindfulness useful to improving my ability to do that. Now, maybe that's because the building blocks were there for me. I was quite aware of what I was thinking, and I was quite aware that I shouldn't necessarily be thinking what I was thinking, and I certainly was thinking some pretty rubbish things, and I was certainly aware of the feelings I was having and what I shouldn't be feeling. So I wonder if you know, we're all human beings, and we all deliver in a style that potentially can fix our lens of the world. I've always been open to it. But equally, I know there are criticisms of mindfulness and meditation. There are definitely people who really struggle to do it because they do have a very noisy mind, and there has been research that has suggested it can actually increase negative affect. Affect is a feeling. So there is some research that might demonstrate that it actually might hinder some people. I just think these are all tools in the toolbox that can be utilized and experimented with. I think every day is an opportunity to hold a mini experiment with yourself to see what works for you, what doesn't work for you, and also recognize that what might have worked for you last year might not work for you now. That's the fun, the fun and games of the mental side, but every side, every component of our sport that we love dearly, you know, that things change and things move and things shift, and we have to flex and adapt appropriately. So, but I've definitely worked with players who I've suggested this to, and I've guided them through it, and it's helped them. So I think these are good tools in the toolbox to have. And hey, look, there's so much literature out there on this stuff. There's so many apps, there's so many people doing them. Who am I to suggest that it doesn't help? You know, I we can't just see the lens of our world through our eyes. You know, we have to be open-minded and explore so many different opportunities.
I've actually seen studies that where they do studies of the brain, and they can literally track how mindfulness changes brain chemistry.
Of course.
And it's wild. So yeah. And like you said, I like the way you put that. Well, you know, if you're open to something and you try it and you give it an honest go and you find it's not working, there's other tools out there that can help players. But so tell us about you've got a new book coming out, and I'd like to hear, you know, why you felt that. So you've written a book specifically for soccer coaches, right?
Yep. In the past,
which applies to all coaches, by the way, of all sports. But and then you've gotten two books, Soccer Tough 1 and Soccer Tough 2 for soccer players. So what new have you discovered that led you to saying, I need to write a third book?
Well, I wrote Soccer Tough back in 2012, and Soccer Brain in 2013, and then I did a Golf One Golf Tough in 2014, and then 2015 was Soccer Tough Two. So I wrote four books in 4 years, and honestly, Don, it was please excuse me for saying this, but it came quite simply and easily and quite naturally to me because I had a lot to say back then, I have to say.
Right.
I'd picked up quite a bit of experience in my playing career, my coaching career, and my early stage of being a psychologist, sports psychologist, and I had plenty to write about. And then I took a hiatus from writing because, boy, I was quite burnt out from doing all the writing.
I bet that's got to be a lot of work.
Yeah, and I was ready to get out there and consult more and start my podcast and do all kinds of projects. So there's been a decade hiatus from writing, but I've always tried to start books. I think if you ever go into my folders online on Dropbox, you'll find about a dozen books that have been started but not got past. Some have got past chapter four and some have got to chapter one, and so there was a lot of stopping and starting. And we're talking now. I think we first started talking about me coming back on the podcast at the back end of 2024, and I
Probably.
and so you've been delightfully patient with me, and I said to you, Don, can you hold up a bit, because I've got this new book coming out. Now we're midway through 2025. Now this book still isn't finished, sadly, but we're not far away. We're in the editing process now, so it is basically done. So we're a couple of months. We're June 2025 at the moment, so we're not far. I'm hoping around October, September, October, but we'll see. We'll see. But look, it's a book about competing. Soccer Tough and Soccer Tough 2 were for players, but coaches read them as well. In fact, all kinds of people involved in soccer and other sports read them. Soccer Brain, as you mentioned, is for coaches. I've gone back to writing for players, but again, coaches and other people in other positions would be interested in this, and it's across all sports, specifically team sports, because I do think the psychology of team sports is a little bit different. There's lots of similarities, but it's slightly different to individual sports.
Right.
Although I do say in the book, in the introduction, that individual sports competitors can read this as well. It's got a working title of one word, compete, because it is about helping players become better competitors. And I'm doing two things here essentially. The thesis is that I want players to be able to go onto the pitch and take control and take charge of themselves. It's pretty similar to what we've been discussing, really. I want them to be able to engage in self-control, to find their best possible mindset, what I call a high performance mindset, to high perform more consistently under pressure, because I think that's a great definition of being a great competitor. A great competitor to me is somebody who can high perform consistently under pressure. Those three things, right? And for me, when somebody knows exactly, and let's talk about soccer here specifically, because I use this model all the time, and this is the model I created the last 2 years working with Arne Slot at Feyenoord in the Dutch Eredivisie. And obviously Arne, those who know soccer well will know of Arne's success at Liverpool Football Club this past year. So I had the honor and the pleasure of working with Arne Slot for 2 years at Feyenoord in Rotterdam, winning the Dutch Eredivisie Championship 2022-2023, winning the Dutch Club Cup 2023-24. And I very much, what's in the book is very much what I introduced to Arne, what I introduced to his coaching staff, what I've worked with other coaches, what I introduced to the players, and when I work with any Premier League player, NWSL player, US women's national team, men's national team player, I will be taking something from what I'm about to talk about. And so we can think of mindset as high performance mindset, average performance mindset, and low performance mindset. That's very much what I'm introducing to the reader. And a big model that we used at Feyenoord was, let's be the best in the world at helping our players find their high performance mindset. Let's make them absolutely brilliant at starting and staying in their high performance mindset, no matter what. Because, and here was a really influential model I created for Arne Slot, because, and you can think about, try to picture this in box format. If we've got that high performance mindset in a box at the bottom of a graphic, leading up to moments, because soccer is a game of moments, isn't it? And we want to win every moment possible. My argument is if we can be in our high performance mindset, we give ourselves our best chance to win more moments. And those moments can be as small as finding space, closing down space, winning a 1v1, getting your head on the ball, getting that, you know, whatever it is. It can be as big as scoring a goal. It can be as big as making a great save if you're a goalkeeper coming for that catch from across. It can be big, it can be small. So picture this, high performance mindset, driving moments, winning moments, driving managing momentum. Because soccer is about momentum, for and against. So this is the way this equation works. My job is to be in my high performance mindset. When I'm in my high performance mindset, I give myself my best chance to win more moments as an individual and as a teammate. When I win more moments, I give myself my best chance to contribute to team momentum. When momentum is against us, when momentum is for us, we can wrestle back momentum. We can keep momentum. Mindset, moments, momentum. And so then the book goes about breaking this down from a high performance mindset and a low performance mindset perspective. And so then I'm saying to the reader, well, what is this thing mindset? What can this consist of? And now we're going to do a little bit more of a deep dive. So I'm going to define mindset as three specific mental skills. And I write, anybody who's interested, anybody who's greedy for more knowledge on this right away before the book comes out, I write every day on LinkedIn and Facebook. On LinkedIn, just search for Dan Abrahams, on Facebook, at Dan Abrahams Soccer. And I use these three mental skills. I write about these three mental skills all the time. For me, when you break down mindset, and I personally believe this is undeniable. In fact, I challenge any sports psychologist. Famous last words, Don, but I challenge any sports psychologist to come along and deny what I'm about to say. I reckon you can load on every single psychological term onto these three mental skills. You know, so when you think about concentration or confidence or motivation, these three mental skills: attention, activation, and action execution. Now, let me just briefly break down each of these. Attention, a focus of attention, a focus of attention. When we strip things back in very simple terms, that attention is the critical piece for players. I don't think it's controversial to suggest that players have to focus their attention. You know, as a goalkeeping coach, what were you doing as a goalkeeping coach? You were helping your goalkeepers to pay attention to their action, to pay attention to opportunities, to dangers, to pay attention to their next action, to pay attention to where their teammates are, to pay attention to where the opposition is, to pay attention to where the ball, tracking the ball, to where the space is, to pay attention to everything that's going on outside of them around, right? So I describe that in your high performance mindset. That's being focused and connected to the game. It is critical that players are connected to the game.
Right.
Now, in a low performance mindset, players become distracted and disconnected from the game.
Yes.
They're distracted by external noise or from internal noise. That can include thoughts, emotions, feelings that are negative, those ants that can distract them. And they disconnect from the game. Because suddenly their attention turns inwards to the thoughts, emotions, feelings, and you know better than I do that as a goalkeeper, that's an absolute killer. If there's a set piece, a dangerous set piece, and that goalkeeper is spending their time with an internal focus of attention on their ants, worried about coming for the catch or where they need to, what they need to be doing in that moment or where their position needs to be. If they're focusing on that too much, then they're going to be distracted and disconnected from the delivery, from where the opposition are, from the danger moments, right? And so players have to stay focused and connected to the game. Attention is about direction and duration. Directing your focus of attention, the best players in the world direct their focus of attention flexibly and optimally with a great duration. They concentrate. Nothing controversial there. Would you agree with me?
I'd agree. And before you go on, I love the word disconnected and connected, because now for a goalkeeper, I mean, I can tell you if a youth goalkeeper is connected or disconnected because I can see the physicality of the connection. So if they're inside their six and the ball's in the other six and there's 50 yards of space between them and the back line, clearly there's the disconnect and they're not focused on controlling the space. But I can do that with a center back, with a center mid, with a winger. I can see when the team moves together, who is connected and who is disconnected. And I had never thought, Dan, that Of course, that's a mental connection and disconnection. And quite often, that player is underperforming. So, therefore, as you're saying, in a low performance mindset.
And I think
Fascinating.
what's really interesting about what you've said there is you the first thing you said is I can see it physically as a goalkeeper coach because you have an eye for this. You've done this for so many years. You see it physically, somebody disconnected. And this is really important. This is what I'm emphasizing throughout the book. You kind of leapt onto some of the intricacies of the later chapters when I talk about the importance of understanding mental skills and mental techniques from an embodied perspective. That mind is body and body is mind. That the body is as important an indicator of mental skills as anything else, and we can use our body to pay attention. And you can highlight this, especially as a child in school when the teacher is at the front of the class and it feels there's a disruption, and that teacher calls everybody to pay attention. What do the kids do? They sit up, they turn their head forward, they open up their eyes. As long as they're being obedient in that moment, they're embodying that notion of attention.
Interesting.
So,
Never connected the two. Yeah.
in many
Makes
respects,
sense.
that's you as a goalkeeping coach. When you say pay attention, you want players to pay attention, yes, with their mind, yes, with their eyes, but with their body as well. Hold yourself with attention, be
Yeah.
ready to execute with attention, follow the ball with attention, and following is the scanning behavior, which still is
Right.
an action,
Right.
right? So absolutely critical is this understanding is when I talk about mental skills, I'm talking about mind and body, body and mind. I'm talking about
Yes.
attention being a bodily process as much as a mental process. And that's absolutely critical to understand. Now, that second mental skill, so we've got attention, focus of attention. And I sat in the room at an MLS team the other day, and I was listening. I had the honor and delight to listen to the head coach, an excellent head coach, talking to his players about the upcoming game, a game that actually they went on to win. And he was talking to his players about he was as coach head coaches do at the adult elite level, the professional level. He's taking his players to who they're facing, the opportunities they're going to get, the exploiting of the principles of play that he wants them to do or she wants them to do, and the threats that they might come up against or the dangers they might come up against.
Right.
And when I was listening, something I said to the head coach afterwards, I said, all I was hearing there was attention. You were directing the attention of your players onto those opportunities and dangers. You want them to pay attention to those opportunities and dangers, embed them and remember them. So
Right.
I'm saying this, Don, because attention has to be that number one skill when it comes to competition. It's that number one mental skill. And you as a goalkeeping coach are constantly honing players' attention. All coaches are constantly honing attention. So that's your number one skill. Number two, activation. So another A, activation. Now, what activation is, the reason I'm using the word activation is because we use this from a physical standpoint. What do
Yes.
sports scientists and strength and conditioning coaches talk about? They talk about players becoming physically activated. When they warm up, we get them physically activated. Now,
Right.
when they warm up, they also help players get mentally activated, but there's so much more we can do here. Okay, so mental activation is mental energy. We want physical energy, we want mental energy, and that mental energy is absolutely critical. And really, you can break it down to two words here: alert and ready, alertness and readiness. Alert and ready. We want players who are paying attention and alert and ready. So we're doing so with real vigilance. Vigilance is a really good word here. I'm constantly vigilant throughout the game as best as I can be. I'm alert and ready, alert and ready. I'm alert and ready to anticipate and exploit the opportunities. I'm alert and ready to anticipate and deal with the dangers. Anticipation and decision making is a great forerunner of activation. And so activation is a close cousin to attention. Because if we think
Okay.
about attention being direction and duration, that activation piece is the strength it makes a difference to the strength of attention. I'm really deeply involved with this game. I'm constantly involved. I'm constantly detecting the opportunities and the dangers. You know, I'm deeply immersed in this game. Attention, activation. Now, the interesting dynamic about activation, let's talk about low performance mindset, because in a high performance mindset, it's simple. The player is optimally activated, alert and ready, alert and ready, vigilant every single second out there. In a low performance mindset, we can go one of two ways. We can climb too high in activation. Now, I'll give you the three main forerunners to overly high activation. One, anxiety. Two, anger. Three, frustration. Anxiety, anger, frustration are for me the three emotions. Activation is, in many respects, an emotional dimension.
Huh.
Anxiety, anger, frustration climbs our activation up. Now, this rings true whereby, and you'll recognize this, a bit of anxiety, great, high energy, readying us to perform.
Right.
Even a bit of anger and a bit of frustration can help. You stand in front of a room full of players and you say, how many of you play better when you're a little bit angry or a little bit frustrated with things? Then, right, that's the energy coursing through your body that is upgrading your body to compete and creating vigilance, because when we're angry, we need to be vigilant about what's going on in front of us.
Right.
But when we get too anxious, too angry or too frustrated, well, our attention can narrow too much. So we play tunnel vision. So we don't start to detect the cues, the clues, the triggers around us, right? When we get too anxious and too angry or too frustrated, our attention turns inwards and we pay attention to the feelings that we're experiencing rather than detecting what's going on around us. So we're not vigilant to what's going on around us.
So I'd imagine, Dan, that's got to be different for every single player, right?
Yes.
I was a very angry player. I mean, the more angry I got, the better I played, the more focused I was. I remember as a goalkeeper standing there and giving up the couple of dumbest goals. I'll never forget one game. I gave up 4.5 goals. And I was so pissed because they were stupid goals. And I went to my team and I swore up a storm and I told them, you know, I will not give up a goal in the second half. You need to get us 5. And I remember how angry I was and made some fantastic saves. And we did. We won 5-4. I mean, it sounds like a story I would make up, but it's true. And I remember that feeling of utter anger. And then I've coached players that appeared to be that angry and that just got worse. It just got worse for them. How does a player know, how can a player recognize their own feelings of anxiety, of anger, of frustration, and how do they learn to recognize when that tipping point comes between helpful and unhelpful?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. And it does require, I mean, the first thing I'd bring you straight back to is that awareness of where I am now. You know, what am I paying attention to? You know, I in the book, I invite people to have moments, sort of check-in moments, to make sure that they're focusing effectively and correctly, which they're staying connected to the game. If you find yourself, the key signatures here is if you find yourself, let's go back to attention, because remember, attention and activation are close cousins. If I find myself becoming distracted and disconnected, so I'm focusing more on my insides and how I'm feeling, or I'm just my anger, my anxiety is disconnecting me from the game, that's my cue to make sure that I, for example, externalize my focus of attention outwards onto what's going on around me. Or I might use, as I talk later in later chapters in the book, how to use your self-talk in that moment to calm yourself down, for example, or breathing to calm yourself down.
Right.
So it is about noticing. It is about being an intelligent consumer of your own sensations, essentially, right?
I like that.
So that's absolutely critical. But the interesting dynamic as well here, Don, is that if we go the other way, the converse here, which is too low activation, there are no redeeming features for low activation.
Right.
And I want to give you the three, for me, in my experience, the three main emotional states and mental states that create low LPM, low activation. And that is complacency, despondency, and lethargy. Complacency, despondency, and lethargy. You know, lethargy, I get up, I'm not, perhaps I've not prepared myself effectively. I mean, you know what, John, a number of you worked in the Premier League for 20 years and a number of Premier League players who said to me, Dan, I was warming up and I just wasn't feeling it. You know, I felt flat. I felt flat. I felt lethargic.
I've heard that from players so many times.
All the time, right? Well, that to me, I'm defining that as lethargy, and they just don't get themselves activated and they don't have the tools to, you know, get themselves. They might be trying to physically do it, but they, for some reason, they can't just get themselves alert and ready, alert and ready. So that lethargy, and you can call it physical lethargy, that's fine, but it's that mental lethargy as well. Despondency. I mean, there is no redeeming feature for despondency, because that is going to play on your action capability and your anticipation and decision making. And again, let's come back to that anticipation to be able to exploit opportunities and deal with dangers. You are dead if you are despondent. You are going to be slow. You're going to lack awareness. You're going to be slow with your anticipation. You're going to be poor with your decision making. So despondency is a real killer. And then complacency is a really interesting one, which again, you know, why are there such things? Why in English football is giant killing in the FA Cup such a massive thing? When you know, I think of all the big giant killings when I grew up, and you know, I think of Coventry City who lost to Sutton United in the late 80s in the FA Cup, or Arsenal who lost to a beleaguered Wrexham back then. They didn't have a couple of
Wrexham was the headline I will never forget in the papers.
Right.
Wrexham, okay. Wrexham.
Now we're going back a few years, but every year there's giant killings. And yeah. With the greatest of respect to the minnows, if you like, it's often because the complacency can set in. Oh, we're just playing them, or we're playing the bottom right. of the league here. So complacency is something. This is why, you know, head coaches in the highest leagues in the world really train with the kind of intensity and warn players of the kind of threats they're going to be facing, and really amplify those, because they don't want their players being complacent, and that is low activation.
It's amazing you bring that up, because I always said to my teams, Dan, the mark of a good team is when we should smash a team, we do smash a team. I mean, we destroy the little ones. And the teams that are about the same of us, we figure out a way to handle them well. 3-1, you know, 3-0, we can handle them well. And the teams that are over us, we figure out some way to overcome and get a draw, or to get a 1-0 win, to eke one out. But the teams, it's funny, the angriest I've ever been as a coach, Dan, it's funny you bring this up, was when we would win 2-1, 3-1 over a team that we should beat by 9. And I've never been more angry, because all I could do was think about the future and the playoffs and or the big games against the big teams, and thinking, well, if we play like that against the poor teams, they'll beat us 9-0. The big ones will. They'll smash us. You have to be, you said this word early on, but consistency. That the way you play, I can't control my outcomes, but what I think I want to be able to control with my teams is the consistency of our play and the consistency of our performance, knowing that if it's all high performance mindset, I had never thought about it this way, but now that you've got me thinking, it was high performance consistently that we would win a lot more than we lose.
And this comes back absolutely spot on. You're taking the words out of my mouth, because as soon as you were regaling this story, I was going to come back to you. Let's define a great competitor. A great competitor or a great competitive team are ones who consistently high perform under pressure. And then you strip that back to, well, how do they do that? Well, they're better at managing momentum, no matter who they play, where they play, when they play. How do they do that? Well, they win more moments, no matter who they play, where they play, when they play. How do they do that? Well, they do that in their high performance mindset, moments, momentum, to have consistent high performance under pressure. So that really that team isn't dropping below at least a 7 out of 10. You know, their worst is 7 out of 10. It's not down at 4. Because down at 4, right, you might still beat that team you should beat, but you're fuming as a head coach, because you're saying, but that is not building the kind of momentum we want into next week when we play that tough opponent.
Right.
So no matter, high performance, a consistent high performance under pressure, drawn back from momentum, moments, mindset. Well, what do we mean by mindset? Well, I've given you two skills already, attention and activation. what I'm hearing from you is no matter who we play, where we play, when we play, I want players to be focused and connected to the game, attention, and I want players to be alert and ready, alert and ready, alert and ready, nonstop. And if my players are alert and ready and focused and connected to the game, wow, then we will give ourselves a great chance to get that 9-0 result against that team we should be beating. Now, let me give you today the third mental skill. And this is really interesting in as much as, to me, this is something that's rarely spoken about, but is constantly mediating performance. Now, we've got attention, we've got activation, and that final one doesn't sound like a mental skill, but I'm going to claim that it is. And that is action execution. And I'm going to define that as the style in which you execute your actions. And I'm going to explain that further by saying, and I'd like you to picture this, in a high performance mindset, players are executing their actions energy forward, with an energy forward intent, purposeful, positive, and proactive with their actions. Approach behavior, moving towards rather than away from, approach rather than avoidant, energy forward and energy forward intent. A positive, purposeful, proactive, picture that, execution of actions. Conversely, in low performance mindset, players are energy back. They're avoidant. They're away from.
Right.
Their energy back, and the three words here I would use are inhibited, hesitant, passive. Passiveness drives coaches mad, I know that much. Hesitancy and inhibition, think of that fear. I'm inhibited,
yes,
and think of that slight hesitation. Now, I can draw on some pretty big case studies here. So again, I was in Philadelphia last week presenting to these goalkeeping coaches, and at convention last year, I showed the same slides, and that was the UEFA technical report from the 2020, which was played in 2021, Euros final, England versus Italy. If you might remember that game, England started with energy forward, purposeful, positive, and proactive. Luke Shaw from fullback scored the first goal 1-0 after 3 minutes. England continued to press and play well, energy forward for the next 10, 15 minutes. After that, they played completely on the back foot. Jordan Pickford had 26 long ball clearances.
Right.
They dropped down to 30% possession. The authors of the report, David Moyes of Everton, Ator Karanka, who used to manage Middlesbrough, an esteemed coach, both looked at the data and wrote about that fear factor. They're something to lose. They were scared of losing that game in the moment. As an Englishman, I feel sad that I've got to reflect on the national team, and please, this is absolutely no disrespect to them because they've done wonderfully well these past 6 years.
Of course.
But even in the Euros, the last Euros, when we actually got to the final, you know, the hesitancy and the inhibition was there. And I've got this wonderful video of Pep Guardiola. It's literally 10 seconds long, urging his players. He says, I hate it when you don't show for the ball. I hate it when you don't show for it. I hate it when you're not.
I think you've posted this. Yeah, I remember seeing this.
He says, you've got permission to make mistakes. You've got permission to give compliments. But I hate it. That is him in coach speak, urging his players to play energy forward rather than energy back, fearing mistakes. You've got permission to make mistakes, but please show for the ball. Please find that space quickly. Please press hard, aggressive. Think of words here: assertive, aggressive, sharp, alert, alive, lively, relentless, dominant. All of these are energy forward behaviors. And so the action-based words, and this, you see, now I think, Don, you'll recognize how this links in with my techniques of game face, for example. So action execution. So we've got three mental skills: attention, activation, and action execution. And they work hand in hand. If I'm anxious, overly anxious, I become distracted. As I become distracted, I become inhibited and I play energy back. Attention, activation, and action execution feed each other, and explain the behaviors from a psychological standpoint. They explain what we're seeing. So this becomes a sense-making tool. This was something I sent to Arnest a lot every day on WhatsApp as a sense-making tool to help him make sense of what was happening on the pitch with his players. And so where I go with the rest of the book, Don, and I'm conscious of our time, so maybe this can be when the book is released.
Absolutely. We'll come back on and we'll talk more about it. Yeah.
This is where I have a number of, so these are the mental skills, working in servitude of high-performance mindset, working away from low-performance mindset, for winning moments, for managing momentum, for consistent high-performance under pressure. So how do we meet these mental skills in a high-performance mindset? Now here's a whole bunch of mental techniques. And I've collated all the mental techniques I've created over the years and into the book, and introduced and reintroduced my audience. Because I go back over Game Face, I go back over Squashing Ants, using controllers, having a match script. I talk more about leadership and teamwork. I talk about confidence and energy for game day. I talk about how to create mental models to improve your ability to be energy forward, to have certainty going to a game. So there's all these mental techniques that I introduce the reader to and reintroduce the reader to, that play on these mental skills. So that, in a nutshell, is, I hope, the book I'm going to be releasing in a couple of months.
That's exciting. And the name again is?
Well, it's Compete. I'm still working on a subtitle. I'm so sorry.
That's the working title.
That's that. But it's Compete, and it's going to have a bit of a subtitle. But you know what? In a way, the book brings us now to 2025. I'm getting to sit down with the best coaches and the best players in the world. I'm humbled and honored to be able to do that on both the men's, the women's, the girls, the boys side of the game. I get to work across America with some great teams from my academy. And so I've really given you a bit of a snapshot of where I am when I sit down with these players and these coaches. You know, I sit down with Arne Slot, who's now at Liverpool, Premier League champion. What I've been talking about is precisely what we're talking about, because players at the highest level need it, and young players in their own filtered way need this kind of stuff as well.
And I know I'm conscious of our time here, Dan. I know you've got a hard out coming up, but I'm wondering, anybody out there listening, don't shoot me for this. I'm just going to tell you what I've noticed. Having coached women in college for over 20 years, and then simultaneously having coached men for a little over half that time, I was coaching both. I noticed that women tend to be a little more hesitant than the guys do. So a guy might overestimate his ability to take a shot, and then a woman might pass it off. And of course, I'm generalizing, a very, very broad general. Have you noticed differences in having to approach women talking about their mindset and all of these things that we've been talking about versus men? I've heard it described to me by coaches that, you know, men, you show them film to prove to them they've done it wrong, and women, you show them film to prove to them that they can do it right.
Yeah.
And I've noticed some truth to that. Tell me the differences that you've noticed dealing with high level women and versus the men, if any.
Well, I think the first answer to that is, I think coaches themselves have to be true to their experiences. And I think if that's, you have many, many years of experience coaching, and if that's true to your experience, then that's something that affords you the opportunity to make a difference to both boys and girls and men and women in a more accurate way for you. I think what I would be willing to commit to, I mean, it's interesting you say that. I remember as a golf coach, the data suggested that women were more and girls were more inclined to have golf lessons than men and boys. Why? Because men and boys just want to give me the golf club, I'm just going to smash it and get on with it. Whereas girls and women, the indication was that they wanted to do it in the right way, which I think is more power to them. That sort of links with what you're saying. I think, as you said, it's a broad brush generalization and treatment, but often these ring true to a degree. And I know personality science has demonstrated across very broad and large studies differences between men and women. I mean, I would always say to people, treat the people you're coaching as individuals, but
right,
as you treat them as individuals, you will probably notice gender differences. What I've heard from you is men are overconfident, and women may have a tendency towards being underconfident. And I love your solution, which is show the men what they're not doing so well and help them to do it. Convince and influence. Coaching is about being an influencer, influence them that way. And if a female goalkeeper, if a female outfielder is coming to you and you're saying, hey, look at this. This is really good. This is what you're great at. And you can be even better this way. I think that's such a powerful position. I think every single player needs to have simple mental frameworks.
Yes.
But what I can absolutely say is I know women and girls are really passionate in this area. They love it. And men and boys,
Yeah.
it's not to say they don't. But I think sometimes the machoism with men and boys can lead them to lack that little bit of vulnerability, and they've got to think
Ah,
that
there you go.
they think
Yeah.
that they have to show the world that they can do it, and that actually deserves their ability in the mid to long term.
Yeah, that's a good generalization to leave it on. And look, I've co it's funny because I've coached women and I've said to them, certain women, it's like, do you play like a man? And I don't mean the way they play physically. I'm just saying the way that they think reminds me more of the way most of the men that I've coached think. And then I've got guys that are think the other think differently and
Coach the
act
individual
differently.
in front of
So
you. Yeah.
yeah, so I hate to broad brushes, but if there are certain things that tend to be true, I think coaches need to be aware of that, and especially men coaching women. And maybe that's where my sensitivity comes in because I am as brutal of a coach as anybody's ever coached. It's just the way I was as a player, the way I was as a goalkeeper, super demanding. And I had to learn to coach women. And I learned that I couldn't just coach them like I coached the men. I had to have a different approach because they wanted to. My first couple of years, I think the head coach, he came to me and said, I should fire you, but I'm not. I'm going to work with you. And that's Lisa Bestsellers. And I owe her my career because she gave me time and patience and coached me that you can't just treat the women like you treat the men. And you can't talk to them the same way. And you can't approach them the same way. And again, broad generalizations, but I found it to be generally true.
And
Yeah.
I think that you've said it much better than I could. So I'm with you all the way there. I'm hearing you, listening to you, and I think that's really interesting.
Well, Dan, I can't thank you enough. I know you've got a heart out here, so I'm going to let you go. But real quickly before we go, how can people get a hold of you? Where can they follow you? Where can they get your books? Give us the quick rundown here.
Well done. Firstly, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I always love speaking with you. Oh, it was super disappointing we didn't get to catch up at the convention this year, but maybe next year. And I'm always, as I said at the beginning of the show, honored and delighted to be involved with SIUSA. So super, super honored to be on your board. So that's fantastic. And look, people can find me at danabrahams.com. And I have an array of social media, as you well know. I'll give you my main X handle, which is at Dan Abrahams 77, giving away my age, at Dan Abrahams 77, at Dan Abrahams Soccer Facebook, which I mentioned earlier, at Dan Abrahams Sport, which is Instagram, and do find me on LinkedIn as well. Just search Dan Abrahams, and you'll see me as a sports psychologist there. And my podcast is the Sport Psych Show, and my online academy you can find, and the books you can find on my website. So, Don, thank you so much for today.
Yeah, and that Sports Psych Show, man, if you guys find that you're into this at all, Dan has some amazing, like world-class guests that some of the best in the business, literally. And if you want to delve deeper into sports psychology, that's the podcast to listen to. It's on my saved podcast, Dan. So it's one of my regulars. I appreciate you. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. We'll see you guys on the next episode. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Dan Abrahams. Go back and listen to our other episodes we've done on him. If you just search Dan Abrahams and Inside College Soccer, you'll come up with all of his other episodes that he's done with us. He's incredible, literally one of the best in the world. What you guys got right now was a master class that he would give that episode to the convention, and there'd be standing room only, packed to the walls. Running out the door, Thousands of coaches a year flock to hear Dan Abrahams. He's world class. We've got a new product that I'd like you to know about, and it's called GapYearSoccer.com. And so if you go to if you've got a child who you think could benefit from growing up a little more, maturing physically, emotionally, before they enter college, that's what a gap year is all about. Gap years are wildly popular in Europe. It's one of the reasons why college soccer is being flooded with older players coming in as freshmen. And I know a lot of frustration. There's a lot of frustration out there from American parents when their 18-year-old has to go compete against a 20-year-old freshman, and you think it's not fair. And I understand it's very difficult. I will tell you, my own son did this. He went away to England for 2 years and spent a little bit of time in Germany and then back to England and came back as a 20-year-old freshman, almost 21, and much, much better as a player, a much more mature adult, having experienced the world a little bit before he took off to play in college soccer. And it influenced how his career went in college. He had a much more successful career. He was a much better leader, a better player, more mature, and was able to handle the ups and downs of college soccer much better, and be more successful. And largely due to that gap year time that he took overseas. So I'm going to highly recommend to any parent who sees their child in that middle ground that maybe they're not mature enough yet. Physically and as a player, and need some more time before they have to go tackle the rough and tumble world of college soccer. That go look at our opportunities. We've got opportunities for players in Spain, in England, in Germany. We're working on other opportunities for them overseas as well. Look, Europe is where it's happening. It's where it's been happening for a long time. The best teams, the best training, the best competition. That we can give to our players often exists outside of what's going on in the United States right now. And so if your child is interested in going to Europe and experiencing soccer overseas, we've got some academies that we've visited, we've vetted, highly respected coaches, academies playing at very, very good levels against very good players with some of the best coaching in the world at some of these academies. So if you're interested in that, go to gapyearsoccer.com and we can get somebody on the phone with you, talk to you, figure out which academy we would recommend to you, and we can make the connections for you. That's gapyearsoccer.com.